session number 10923, Reel 7.
Mr. Harold Harper, Reel 7. We were talking about some of the animal forms and life in the desert at the Tobruk area. Did you see any of the desert rats?
Yes, we saw quite a number of those. They were very tame animals. So tame, in fact, that on more than one occasion we would see a bunch of Australians engaged in racing these rats against each other for huge bets, knowing, of course, that the Australians are very gambling-minded. So jerboas didn't really present any serious problem to us, in as much as they were very tame.
Did they try and get at your rations, or was there a problem in any way?
No. I had no recollection of them getting at the food at all.
You mentioned the Australians. How did you get on with the Australians?
Oh, excellent. They, probably on more than one occasion, we rescued them from difficult situations, and they took us to heart. And because our cap badge was unlike the normal Royal Artillery badge, our cap badge was in the form of an acorn. They called us the Acorn Gunners. And that name stuck with us for the rest of the war. And they issued all sorts of wild invitations to us at the time, that all we needed to do was to stand in the middle of Sydney after the war and say you were an acorn gunner and you'd be made for life, so to speak. But so we got on with the Australians very well indeed.
Mm-hmm. Did you find their approach to military life differed at all?
Yes, very, very different. They were far less disciplined than we were. The casualties were, a lot of them, quite unnecessary, in my opinion.
Why was that?
Because of the indiscipline of the infantry.
But in what way would that?
In as much as they would sort of go into a situation fearlessly. Let's be fair about this. They were fearless soldiers. Sort of saying, well, you know, we'll go and sort these Huns out, so to speak, without this method, the correct method of approach, the sort of which you'd expect from the normal British infantryman.
So they weren't as militarily efficient?
No. I would say that, definitely. But courage, You couldn't blame it, you know, in any way, shape or form. They were very courageous men.
What about the way that their military discipline, not in fighting, but towards their officers and such? How did that strike you?
Because they spoke to their officers in sort of very man-to-man sort of attitude, whereas by then we had got quite a rapport with our officers. We still, despite that situation, we still respected the rank. That was the important thing.
How did you? I'm quite interested in that, though. How did you talk to your officers, and how did they talk to you?
In Tobruk. Yes. Well, by that time, officers and men were very friendly. No doubt about that. There was never any sort of animosity between the two.
How would they address you? I mean, you were a bombardier. How would they would they call you bombardier?
They say bombardier, yes.
And how would you address them?
Oh, captain or lieutenant.
So the forms,
sir,
the forms, yeah, of rank were maintained.
There was always this close friendship.
Did the topics of conversation broaden out from what you'd normally expect, for instance,
yes,
at home?
Yes, no doubt about that. They would talk about anything. I mean, obviously there was hours and hours of boredom, if you like, and particularly if you've got to be on duty, on the lookout. I mean, it was difficult to not to sort of engage in all sorts of frivolous conversation.
And this conversation would become friendly?
Oh, very friendly indeed, yeah.
So, although the formal, the styles of rank were maintained,
the conversation was very friendly indeed, yes, no doubt about that.
What about the role of officers in contrast to the role of NCOs? Who do you think, what was the relative role of the two things? I know you went higher, so I want to say a junior NCO, perhaps for the most, because you did go to, you became Sergeant Major, but at this stage, who do you think ran the battery? Was it the NCOs, or was it the officers, or how did it work?
I would think it was the senior NCOs, the sergeant majors, who were the main. They were more responsible for running the battery than anybody, I would think.
So
you got two troop sergeant majors and the battery sergeant major.
And they
maintained what little bit of discipline was necessary. They maintained it without. But there again, the sergeant majors always were very, very friendly with the troops. But they knew that the troops would respond as and when necessary. That was the important thing.
And what then was the role of the officers? I mean, so you had the sergeant majors maintaining discipline and probably organisation. You didn't mention that, but I mean.
That's right.
What did the officers put on top of that from their rank?
I would think. Oh, a very difficult one. This.
I'll prompt you. Was it gunnery expertise? Would they?
Yes, I would think expertise probably was there.
What about leadership?
And leadership, yes. They had to display. Yes, leadership and expertise, I think, were the two things. Are we still recording? That's okay, then. Fair enough.
And do you think they performed that role adequately?
Yes. Like everyone else, the officers improved as the situation grew. We all knew what our job was, and we all became, I would think, reasonably proficient in it.
Now, I'm going to come on to the OP work that you did later, but before we go on to that, you said that you were encouraged to learn all the trades, be a jack of all trades.
Yeah.
Well, could you explain what the motivation behind that was?
Well, I think there again to relieve boredom, and also, of course, in other words, to be able to step in if anything should go wrong. There's always this danger that the command post could be blown up, and loss of a gun team, or loss of an OP section. So, whereas most people could drive, it wasn't everyone who could lay a gun. So we all had a go at laying the gun. We all had a go at giving the orders on the gun. We all had a go at while it's operating. And we all had a go at, those of us who were in that area, so to speak, we all had a go at giving instructions to guns and giving instructions from the OP.
Now, was this formal training, or was this just informal?
No, informal.
And how was it effective? Did you actually?
In other words, to a certain extent, we helped ourselves. In other words, I would think nothing at the time of just going and sitting on a gun and saying, "Right, I'll have 5 minutes if you don't mind." And the chap concerned would be quite happy. He'd probably go and put his head down for half an hour. Just in case, yes. And we'd sit on the gun and have a cup of tea and all that, mug of tea. It was all, the atmosphere was all friendly.
So you knew
exactly what to do the moment anything happened. This was the important thing. So, I mean, people like myself would not be averse to going out onto one of the gun teams having a game of cards. Because I knew the very first moment anybody shouted anything, I would be back in that command post within 10 seconds, and we would be back to normal, so to speak.
You mentioned cards. Was there a lot of cards played?
It's amazing where the packs of cards came from, really, because it was about one of the few things which kept chaps going.
What sort of games would be played?
Oh, mainly pontoon, of course, was the main card game in the army. Brag.
Was there much gambling?
Oh, yes.
What level was it at?
A very modest level, quite frankly. Unlike the Australians, who would gamble on anything. I mean, you'd only got to say to an Australian, I think it's going to rain, and he would say, I bet you it doesn't, and or 50 piastres, or whatever it is. The Australians were born gamblers, of course.
Did you play much cards?
Yes, I did.
Any other games played?
No. Oh, yes, I must. You reminded me. The Australians taught us a game called stick and duck or something or other, whereby you threw a boulder in the air and hit it with a stick, and it went a certain distance, and you had to say there and then how many paces. And if you got within 2 paces or whatever it was, that was your score. But if you got outside those, if you weren't near enough with your estimate, the paces, you were out, so to speak. That was called stick and duck or something or other. But that was an Australian game that they obviously played in the outback, which we took off them.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes. Anything which alleviated the monotony.
Anything else?
No, I can't think of any other games, quite frankly.
In your position, with access to radios, would you, in your command post, and would you get any broadcasts, sir?
Yes. We weren't supposed to turn off of the regimental network, but if we hopefully used to get a spare set whereby we could listen to broadcasts.
What sort of thing would you get there?
A lot of propaganda, unfortunately.
Who from?
Lord Haw Haw.
What did you think of that?
We thought it was funny.
Did you believe any of it?
No. The only effect I can ever remember of German propaganda getting through to certain members of the battery was the lady who originally sang Lily Marlene. And of course, as you know, that was originally a German song. And she used to say, they used to call us the self-contained prisoners of Tobruk. That's what they used to start off by calling us. How are you this morning? And this seductive voice would say, of course, while you are here and slaving away, and the rest, your girlfriends and your wives are enjoying life with the Americans back in England, you see, and all this and that. And occasionally you get a bloke who would say, I'm dead from my wife for 6 months, you know, and he would get through to him that way. Of course, I was single, so it didn't bother me, but...
Would you get any light entertainment broadcast?
No, we made our own entertainment.
How? I meant on the radio, you know.
No, nothing on the radio. No, yes, in all fairness, we'd listen to the record programmes from, I think, the issue from Cairo, I think. But in Tobruk, it was not easy to receive. It was a long way from Cairo.
We were
really and well and truly cut off, and we couldn't get England at all, but we did get this German sort of station that kept providing us with music. So it was either the Germans or nothing, really, at one time.
So it was the Germans.
Yeah. And occasionally we would get a newspaper if one of the ships had managed to get through from. And of course the newspaper would be about a fortnight late, but apart from that, no problem.
Well, you said you made your own entertainment. Is there any other ways of...
Yes, two or three blokes had got ukuleles. and you know, we would get round and have a bit of a sing-song. That's the only thing I can think of.
Wouldn't that mean that you were having too many people in one place at a time? I mean, how many?
Yeah, we would be very discreet about that, because we would only do that sort of thing only when there was a sort of, when we'd heard nothing from the Germans for a day or two, and we would then sort of take a chance and probably get about 10 or 15 blokes all together.
And where would you go?
Normally in a gun pit, or normally sort of in a dugout way behind the guns. Mm.
Anything else to entertain?
No entertainment, no. Of course, there was always the odd bloke who got a mouse organ. But not many of those, quite frankly.
Did you get letters and parcels from home?
Yeah, very, very rare. Terrible. The mail situation in Tobruk was terrible, because and often when we got it, you could tell it had been in the sea, because you know, there's salt water all over it and goodness knows what else. Now, as far as mail was concerned, that was the worst part of the war.
As did you miss it?
I mean, yes, oh yes. Yes, we don't know, quite frankly, how much of our mail was getting back either.
You were writing back, were you?
We were managing to write back, but how far it was getting back, we don't know.
Was there any censorship on what you wrote?
Yes, except when they say censorship, we were allowed what they call green envelopes. In other words, you were given one envelope per week, which you could use, and that would not be censored at the regiment, but it could be censored at headquarters. And occasionally there was evidence that one or two of these envelopes had been opened.
What sort of thing would you write home about?
That was one of the most difficult things. You certainly couldn't write about the war, because we weren't allowed to. So, to find a subject to talk about, to write home, was almost impossible. So, penning a letter together was not the easiest thing. You know, you could sort of hint and say, you know, we're out in the desert and all that sort of business, and it's very hot and what have you. And
would you know you were at Tobruk?
No, although having said that, the fact that we were a Nottingham regiment and we were all from the same area, then somehow or other the news would leak through that we were in Tobruk. So I think everybody in Nottingham knew that the South Knots were in Tobruk.
What about parcels? Any parcels from home?
Yes. I got a parcel once which had been on the way so long. My mother had put 2 bars of carbolic soap in, and also some Cadbury's chocolate. And the Cadbury's chocolate tasted of soap. It was like eating soap, quite frankly. And then I think the parcel had been on the way. I think I got it sometime about, I think it was about 4 or 5 months after it had been posted.
Is that the only one you got? There.
Didn't get many in Tobruk, no. Certainly not.
When you got a parcel, what sort of thing would be in it? You mentioned 2 things, but anything else?
Mostly razor blades. The sort of things which, you know, shaving soap. Soap and little bits of, as I say, chocolate and sweets.
Would you share them with your friends?
Oh, yes. Yes. Oh, yes. There's no shadow of doubt about it. You always shared everything.
What about observation post work then?
Yeah.
Were you always in the same OP?
No. As a matter of fact, I mentioned earlier about the concrete emplacement OP. It became obvious that these were not suitable as the they were in full view of the Germans, and it was decided that we would build alternative OPs, and the Australian engineers did these in the form of a scaffolding, towers, there were about four of them for each regiment, and the scaffolding would be about 6 foot wide, square, and stand about anything between 40 to 60 feet high. And in the top, it was like a prisoner of war sort of outlook post. And we had all the equipment in the top, and we had to sort of scale up this thing, and it was absolutely perpendicular. And it was a good job we were only young lads, otherwise I don't know how we'd have got up there. But these were put about 1,000 yards behind the ridge, so that only the top of the these towers could see over the ridge into the enemy land. And one afternoon, it was during a pretty boring period, and we had our infantry we were supporting with the KDGs.
The who?
King's Dragoon Guards. And one young officer of the King's Dragoon Guards, who was a little bit fed up with inactivity, asked if he could come up to the top of our OP to see what was going off. And the Australian engineers, in building this OP, had left one piece of metal, which in scaffolding, which was about an inch and a half across, and about 2 feet long, sticking out of the actual square at the top. Are you with me? And the Germans fired around, and it actually hit that piece of metal sticking out, an inch and a half square, or inch and a half round. And the KDG officer, who was sitting with his legs astride, out with his legs outside the OP, took the full blast and was killed. It was a particularly nasty moment, because we had somehow to get his body down. And getting it down this sort of 40 to 50 feet of scaffolding with steps about 2 feet apart was not the easiest of jobs. And then, having done that, I will say this much, that Captain Birkin... sorry. Captain Birkin would not allow anyone up there until he cleaned the place up, which I thought was... The typical of a South Knots officer.
Oh, he cleaned up all...
He cleaned all the mess up himself before he'd allow even myself to go up and sit in the place. So that was one...
What was it like up in one of these? Didn't you feel exposed?
Very exposed indeed. You know, you're sort of... You got the impression, quite frankly, that you were there on your own and the rest of the world had left you, because you felt as though every German in the German army was looking at you.
So there'd be you.
And what we had to do was not only was to observe for our own, but we had to observe anything that went on in the front and report it back, so that other batteries could take and get the information, you see. And it was whilst we were up there that we did a lot of flash spotting at night.
What was the team up there?
And incidentally, I don't think we've mentioned this, but it got bitterly cold at night in Tobruk. And this was one of the problems that of desert warfare. I suppose it wasn't really cold, but it was, by contrast to the day, it got bitterly cold. We used to wear greatcoats. In the daytime, we wore virtually nothing.
So who would be up with one of these things? Would it be you, the signaller?
The signaller, myself, and officer.
And that was it?
That was it, yeah. And what was we were self-contained.
What was the routine of a journey? I mean, how did you sort out the day?
We took it in turns to be up there, the officer and myself. We'd split the time.
Oh, so you weren't all three up at once?
No. We were in the dugout below, you see.
So just... So
there'd be just the two people at the top, or two people at the top normally.
Who would they normally be?
Well, the signaller, but often you'd find yourself up there on your own.
Because you could use the radio.
You could use the radio, yeah.
So the radio was up there?
It was up there, yeah. No, I've got it wrong. I'm sorry, but I'm just thinking... No, we had a telephone up there. The radio was down below, and we sent the message down by the telephone, so people like myself were quite capable of sending a message down a telephone, and then the signal would pass it on from down below. No, the signal didn't go up to the top.
What did you use to see with? I mean, did you have binoculars?
Binoculars, yes.
Were they issued?
Oh, yes, yes, issued binoculars.
And what sort of thing could you see from up there?
General traffic movement. Even we could see aeroplanes taking off from El Adam Aerodrome. So we would report those, just in case they were heading our way.
About what was your range of vision? Approximately.
8,000, 10,000 yards. Of course, we talked in yards in those days.
And what sort of target would you be interested in for the South Knots? I mean,
vehicle movement, transport. At that stage, it was more harassing fire that we did, just to let the Germans know that we were still interested, that they just couldn't move around without having to take some sort of precaution, and. Because don't forget, at that time, their front line was at Saloum. They'd pushed the English army back right to the borders of Egypt, and they'd bypassed Tobruk. And of course, their main route to bypass Tobruk was to go on the El Adam Road, which was, as I said before, about 5 miles south of.
And that was in your range.
Just within our range, yeah.
Could you?
It was not within our range of our 25 pounders, but we had an Italian gun, which we took over, and we used to harass them by firing this darn great thing.
This is what they called the bush artillery.
That was the bush artillery.
Did you have anything to do with that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes, I pulled the lanyard for that many a time, standing at a distance of about 30 yards from the gun. We never used to stand close to it.
You didn't trust it?
Because we never trusted it, no.
That was...
And the first round we ever fired with that, we put so much cordite in the barrel, we never observed the shot falling. We think it's still going, quite frankly.
What was the situation? How did you come by?
And the only reason we used that was because we were getting so short of our own ammunition.
Were there any other guns? Because there were more than one in this bush artillery, weren't there? Were there any other guns you remember?
No, I can't remember any other than this big Italian gun, quite frankly.
Were you detailed to fire it?
No. I think we all decided to have a go with it. Nobody detailed anybody.
So it was just for fun, almost.
That's right. Can I come back to something you mentioned earlier?
Yes.
You said any other forms of entertainment. And you've just reminded me now. We occasionally used to have a spelling bee. Anything to take our minds off the war. We'd have spelling bees and things like
that. What were they?
Well, spelling bees came out just before the war on the radio. They were very popular. And we were given, you know, somebody would quote a word from the dictionary and you had to spell it. And we had different teams. Each troop was against each other and the battery headquarters had a team. And it was all very good fun.
And they were popular?
Oh, yes. But we didn't have many of them, but perhaps... And of course we had the occasional church service. If you call that entertainment.
Were many of the men religious?
It's quite surprising. The services were reasonably attended, yes.
Where were they held?
Oh, well, in the rear of the gun position. Yeah. Usually in some sort of dugout.
Were you religious at the time?
Not exceptionally, but I attended occasionally. It wasn't always convenient, to be honest, because you might have been, if they held the thing at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning, you might have been on duty, you see, so...